Welcome to eHealth Talk, a podcast from Health Informatics New Zealand and hosted by me, editor of eHealth News, Rebecca Macbeth. This podcast provides a regular roundup of news and views from across New Zealand's data and digital health sector. Please be sure to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Hello and welcome to our eHealth Talk monthly news roundup for August 2021. We skipped July due to school holidays, so there's plenty to catch up on. And as always, I'm joined by HINZ board member and chief executive of Dementia NZ, Scott Arrell. Welcome, Scott. How are you? And how are you coping in this latest level 4 lockdown?
I'm pretty good, thank you very much. Here we go again was the feeling, eh? And as you know, and a lot of your listeners know, I'm sort of a crazy running nut, and been able to get out and do a few runs, but you know, obviously very carefully. Tend to do it early morning or late at night when there's not too many others around. But some of my running friends have been caught up in the location of interest, you know, the Tocha Park Trail Run. So all of a sudden, the sort of messenger group sort of lights up with people heading off to get their tests, and so I was feeling quite comfortable that I hadn't done that one. I'm not a trail runner, so I wouldn't have done it anyway. But it's easy to sort of sit at home and think, oh gosh, you know, this is the pain, isn't it? But you know, it's good to see so many people that are, you know, getting tested, getting vaccinated, and so on. I suppose the biggest strain goes on Wi-Fi, and so yeah, that's the all the neighbourhood with the kids at home and people working at home. The one thing for me is, you know, I don't have young kids running around as well. I think I just got to look after Baxter, my border terrier. He keeps coming into my office now and again, thinks I'm here to play with him all the time.
Yes, I'm sure everyone is quickly adjusting to having a few more people or animals around their office than usual. On the lockdown that was announced on August 17th, GPs and other health services were again forced to make a sudden switch to digital first options for patient consultations in order to prevent the spread of the virus. And I spoke to Royal New Zealand College of GPs President Samantha Merton, who said that the overnight change in approach was a smoother transition for general practice this time around, as most have increased their capability in the telehealth space over the past 18 months. However, while some GPs have surged ahead, others, particularly smaller practices, had essentially reverted to business as usual after the initial lockdown period due to the time and resource needed to invest in digital solutions. So there was a lot of talk about COVID-19 being a game changer in terms of uptake of telehealth, but do you think this has been borne out, Scott? And if not, why not?
Well, I think it's patchy still. I think it definitely has been an improvement. Yeah, there would be, man, we'd be really worried if there hadn't been. And yes, there have been some probably more the larger practices, and you know, where there's multiple GPs and got the resources, I guess, who have taken the opportunity to sort of ramp up their telehealth offering, get ready for the next one, and the next one is here now, of course. Others, you know, I think of Carl Cole, you know, and his colleagues out at Otahu, and you know, who were already, you know, sort of quite a long way down the path in terms of the use of telehealth systems and going virtual. And I was been reading a little bit of things that he's been putting up on LinkedIn, and you can see that, you know, he and ones like him have really taken the opportunity to, you know, make, you know, sort of as virtual as possible. Even though Carl, if he's listening to this, doesn't like the word virtual, of course, but you know, the whole telehealth offering. On the other hand, yeah, even smaller practices, if they haven't really embraced it, you know, and moved away from reliability on bricks and mortar, then you know, that is disappointing, because you know, ultimately it's their patients that, you know, that should drive this sort of thing. And you know, I've had some friends, you know, and they know what I'm like, I guess, and you know, say, oh well, my practice isn't offering telehealth, and I said, well, go find one that is. You know, just yeah, the consumer should determine, you know, the service offering at the end of the day. I know it's not that simple when it comes to general practice, but yeah, it's things like e-commerce is not new. You know, that's no longer an excuse. Never was an excuse, even last year, to be honest. They just weren't ready for it. They should be ready now. You know, there's a lot of businesses from, you know, I've ordered two or three things late last week online. relatively small businesses, and I've paid with my visa, and the goods have turned up by courier. Obviously, the GP doesn't have to courier me their goods, but e-commerce is not new. It's been around a very long time, and there's some very large businesses like Amazon that make billions out of it, and there's some very small businesses making thousands out of it. So I guess I can rant and rave on about this for a long time because I'm such a big advocate for it. Models like Tend, you know, they've come into the market, you know, that's baked in. And yeah, that probably my only thing is I'm surprised they haven't scaled quicker and larger, and that others haven't come in also to challenge in that space. But you know, I guess time will tell.
Mm. Yeah, it's certainly an interesting space to watch, and especially some of the other services that go with that. There certainly has been very good uptake of e-prescribing, for example. I think about 900 practices are doing that these days. So, I guess the digital switch is happening faster in some areas than others, perhaps.
Yeah, and I would just say, I can remember, because I was in the thick of things last year, with the first lockdown, in my previous role, and with the telehealth leadership group and the fantastic work, frankly, that the rest in the group were doing. I felt like a passenger, frankly, but, having been involved in that, and so much work was put in, it was kind of 0 to 100 kilometres an hour. This time around, it should only be like 100 kilometres an hour to 110 kilometres an hour. It's only incrementally, only a small sort of press on the accelerator to have your telehealth systems in place. All the hard work's been done. It's there. I don't think any GP should be saying, oh, it's too hard, because it isn't actually. There are so many resources and so many people there to help now that weren't there before, 12 months ago. Well, let's make it 18 months ago. I could accept that as an excuse, but not now.
So meanwhile, the rollout to the public of a national tool for booking COVID-19 vaccinations was described as a resounding success by Director General of Health Ashley Bloomfield. More than 100,000 appointments were made on the first day of Book My Vaccine going live to the public on July 28th, and 195,000 appointments on August 18th, when more than 7,500 people were using the site per minute during the 1 p.m. press conference. So New Zealand's not had a national vaccination booking tool before. Would you say this is an impressive achievement on the part of the Ministry of Health?
Yes, would be my very short answer to that one. I mean, considering where it was before and the journey it's taken, I'm only saying my assessment based on Ashley Bloomfield seems a lot more comfortable and confident at the 1 p.m. presser when he's talking his numbers, and as in the past we sort of got a feeling that there was a bit of nervousness about giving out some of the numbers and what might get thrown back at him if they weren't right. So I am basing it as an interested observer, of course. We've booked we've booked our appointments. I don't think it was August 18th. It would have been close, though. And I have to say, wasn't quite sure how well it was going to go, but the system worked, and we made our booking. Got to wait 6 weeks for my first jab, of course, which usually I don't mind waiting for a jab. I'd rather not have a jab, but sort of the wait time now is the factor, of course. But the booking process was good, and when you think about the numbers of people that would have been online doing it all at the same time, that's impressive.
Mm. Yeah, I can't imagine there's that many national health IT go lives that are described as a resounding success by the Director General of Health. Can't think of that many historically, perhaps. So
no, that's right. And I don't know Ashley at all, really, but he comes across as a conservative sort of chap. And for him to use those sort of words means, it's probably in reality, it's like massive backslapping for Shane Hunter and his team. You've done a great job, mate. So it's that would be one pressure point. Kind of off their chests at the moment, off their shoulders, and good on them for, I think a lot of work's been done, put in.
So this month, the Minister of Health announced that a new set of health system indicators will be published quarterly in an online dashboard. 12 indicators have been developed by the Ministry of Health and the Health Quality and Safety Commission and reflect the government's most important priorities, such as improving child wellbeing and mental wellbeing. So these indicators replace the national health targets that were retired in 2018. What do you think about this announcement, Scott? Does the health system need targets or indicators to measure its success? And if so, does the New Zealand system have the data quality needed to make these meaningful?
Yeah, they're really good questions and difficult ones to answer, because targets of any sort are always can be a motive. And then you talk about whether they're qualitative or quantitative or a mixture of both. Personally, I don't think the data quality is there to be, you know, that sure that we're going to get the sort of reporting against the targets that we expect or would like. However, personally, I think better to have some targets than none. And, you know, there's been a period of time where we haven't had them. When was it 2018? Gosh, that doesn't seem that long ago. But, you know, governments of the day, and, you know, so this is sort of an apolitical statement, you know, have, whether it's in health or in other sectors, put targets in place or indicators, and, you know, they always tend to create some sort of response, don't they? And the response generally comes around about what's been left out. And, you know, the government of the time now, you know, has obviously got its priorities, and so they've been you know, pulled into those indicators. So in summary, really, yes, good that we've now got some. I think it's been too long coming, but yeah, pat on the back for the Minister and the Ministry of Health for getting them in place, because you always sort of get shot down when you do something like this. So at least they're doing it. You know, I can think, you know, that clearly there's an argument about, well, what's happened about, you know, cancer indicators, cancer targets. In the sector that I currently work in, I would say, hey, what about dementia? Because there's thousands of people right now missing out on real services that they sorely need, you know, because they have dementia or the onset of dementia. So I would be saying, and I do say, well, what are we doing about that unmet need? Where's the targets for them, other than the ones that the sector, you know, the NGOs like ourselves come up with? So you can never please everybody. So, you know, at least we've got some targets. I think the challenge in the next year or two is going to be about, well, you know, are the results that we're getting, you know, the actual indicators, do they really reflect reality? You know, and that will come back to data in, data out, you know, rubbish in, rubbish out, that type of thing. So the sector will have to shift. And at the same, you know, we've got health reforms going on. I'm thinking about the whole process for people in the system, you know, having to adopt these and put these in place. So quite a bit of work to do. I hope that people aren't expecting too much in the first year or two.
Yeah, there's certainly plenty going on in the health system. I'm never short of things to write about, which is good.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I also recently wrote about the trial of an artificial intelligence retinal screening tool, which was developed in New Zealand, called Thea. It's created by Toku Eyes and was trialled on more than 900 patients who are part of the diabetic screening program at Counties Manukau DHB and a private optometrist in Palmerston North. De-identified images were screened as usual by retinal specialists, as well as by Thea, and the AI did not miss any patients with more than mild or vision-threatening disease, and the level of agreement with the clinicians was between 91% to 98%. Do you think we're going to see more widespread use of AI tools such as this to help with decision-making and increase capacity in the health sector, Scott?
Yeah, I, again, a blunt response, really. Yes, we have to. You know, it's that, you know, you've heard me rant on in the past about the headcount paradigm. How do we bridge that gap between, you know, increased need, increased demand for services, and a diminishing supply of human beings to provide those services? You know, it's a, you know, we've got this ever increasing gap between, you know, between those two factors. So AI is one of those things in terms of technology, you know, that's going to help to bridge the gap. It's not the only answer, but it's one of. And you know, we've had dermatology doing it in a certain way for quite some time. And I say certain way because, you know, we've seen, you know, what we would now call, you know, quite crude approaches to it, which were, a lot of it was around texting photos, for example, which, you know, some specialists would be cringing that I've even said that openly, but I don't think it's any secret. So, but those days are past, and you know, my friend Stephen at Zillow would probably have a nightmare if I said that it was happening nowadays, and I hope it isn't. But the, you know, right, but that's still, even if it's about photos being shared securely across specialists, for example, or clinicians, that's still about human beings doing the assessment work, isn't it? And having to do all of the assessment work, not just the top level, really serious ones. If you can use AI to screen out, and then, you know, in this case, this trial seems to be an incredible success. And, you know, if we're talking 91-98% kind of level of agreement from clinicians, that's, you know, that's pretty high. And then that leaves the clinicians who are available, you know, and again, a diminishing or a limited resource, you know, to look at the ones that get, you know, that they should be looking at and only looking at, leave AI to do the rest. You know, where I started with dermatology, I think, you know, globally that's now, you know, taking off big time, isn't it? Areas like this seem to me to be sort of a no-brainer. Again, from my very basic viewpoint, I think the concern with this, sorry, I'm jumping around a little bit here, but I think the concern is just making sure that there's efficacy behind them, isn't it? They're saying, well, you know, how can we trust that AI can do better or as well, you know, as a set of clinicians would. And then, of course, you can prove it. In this case, you might prove it in this trial. Dermatology might prove it. But then, you know, there's lots of other areas that you still got to have that proof to give people confidence, mainly the clinicians, because that's their job, isn't it? They want to be, you know, as confident as possible about a diagnosis. And, you know, because it's a pretty stressful one if you're telling someone that they've got something that they don't. And so they've got to have trust and confidence in artificial intelligence to do, you know, that it's sort of an 80-20 rule, isn't it? If you could get AI doing 80% of that level of diagnosis, screening and so on, and leave the really difficult stuff to the human beings, the 20%, and then we're a long way along the line of bridging the yeah, that paradigm that I talk about.
Mm. Yeah, it's an interesting one. And actually did a podcast with Kevin Ross from Precision Driven Health recently, where we talked a little bit about the ethics of AI and machine learning. And yeah, there's certainly a lot to think about in terms of, yeah, if you adopt algorithms or AI, mm. and then they do make a mistake or something is missed, then who's ultimately responsible for that? So there's so many tricky questions, but there's certainly questions that arise with human behavior as well. So it's good to have, people are definitely thinking about it, which is a good place to be.
Yeah, I agree. And yeah, the whole ethics around the thing is immense, and I don't pretend to understand or be an expert in it, of course, but yeah, I've spent time speaking with Kevin, and you know, who is an expert in that area, and you know, it's there's a pragmatic approach, isn't there? And that's kind of where they're coming from, that you could actually spend so much time worrying or trying to make it so perfect that you'd never actually ever do it and you know, do we believe that every clinician coming out of university is perfect on day one? Well, no, we don't, do we? They've got to learn as well. One of the things that comes out of AI is its own ability to teach itself, based on, you know, and if it's picking up on its errors, if it's making errors, it gets better and better and better. Now that's the theory of the thing. So, you know, and if that's correct, then you know, I suppose clinicians and maybe just us as human beings might get worried that, you know, the AI is just so smart that it's smarter than us, and we just don't like that, do we? So, but if we can bridge the gap, you know, the headcount paradigm is a, you know, even though it's sort of a made up word that I came up with, this is a real thing, no matter what you want to call it. If we don't kind of get some of these things in play, you know, I just don't understand how we can, the level of unmet need just grows and grows and grows, and we just don't have people to keep throwing at that unmet need. You know, even again, if I can hark back to into where I am at the moment, you know, with the dementia field, it's, you know, there is a critical lack of people with the ability to deliver the services, and even less funding to pay the ones we've got, let alone more that we need. So how do we use in the dementia area? How are we going to be using technology differently and better than we are now? That, you know, those are challenges that I think every sector of the health sector is having to face.
Definitely. And I think they are being brought into stark relief at the moment with a lot of commentary around our current capacity in the health sector and our ability to deal with a major outbreak of COVID-19. So certainly top of mind at the moment, I think, capacity issues.
Yeah, and I'm not an advocate for that. We would totally replace every clinician with a piece of tech. You know, that's you know, touch wood, hopefully never going to happen, and it shouldn't. But we also have to, because I've had clinicians say to me, "Well, Scott, you just want us to lose our jobs," and I said, "No, I don't." And you know, as long as you're good at your job, then you should stay on your job, because there's not enough of you. Tech will never replace you because there's never enough. So, you know, tech has just got to complement you and help you. And if we can get to that happy balance, then it'll be, you know, we can start to see light at the end of the tunnel.
Great. And just lastly, in HINS news, we've had 16 new members of the Fellow of Health Informatics New Zealand program have been announced, and it's another great cohort. As a board member, you helped to assess the first round of applications. Were you impressed by the calibre of applicants, and what does it say about the Fellows program that so many people are applying?
Well, firstly, there was a very long queue, and you know, people checking the applications and serious people too. You know, it wasn't just like people thinking, "Oh, well, I wouldn't mind having that honorific after my name, so I'll just you know, throw an application at this." These people making applications are, for want of a better term, they are heavy hitters in our health system and the health sector. So that was great to see. So it does demonstrate the value and the quality of the program. I think it's fantastic. The caliber was high, and because of that, the program itself, one perpetuates the other, doesn't it? You know, so the caliber, any program like this, a fellows program, is only ever as good as the people in it and the applicant and the people wanting to get into it. So I think that's what we're seeing. A great cohort. They should be, and I hope, I'm sure they are, they should be using that honorific with pride.
And thanks for joining me today. So I look forward to another discussion next month, and we will hopefully be out of lockdown then, fingers crossed. Thanks to all our listeners. And if you can take the time to like and subscribe to this podcast, that will help other people find us. Thanks for listening to eHealth Talk. Be sure to subscribe and share with your colleagues and friends. eHealth Talk, eHealth News, and the eHealth TV webinar series are supported by Health Informatics New Zealand. See hims.org.nz for more information and become a member starting at just $17 a month. We also have affordable organisational membership options now for both our industry partners and healthcare providers.